Hi, this is Nancy Clare, and welcome to episode 18 of Speaking of Mysteries. This week, Leslie Klinger and I talked to Laura Caldwell, lawyer, distinguished scholar in residence at Loyola University Chicago School of Law, director of Life After Innocence, and the author of 14 novels, including the Izzy McNeil series of mysteries and one nonfiction book. Of course, as a serial multitasker, that is not all that's on Laura's plate. In our interview, she and Les discuss their joint project that pairs renowned mystery and thriller writers with innocent people who have been convicted of crimes, incarcerated, and then released to tell their stories. Here's Laura and Les.
Laura, you, having had an undergraduate major, you always say, in beer and cheerleading,
went football on... and beer is what I really say.
Okay, so
cheerleading for the football.
Went on to Loyola Law School and for 10 years practiced law as a medical malpractice defense lawyer.
Right.
And then decided to be a writer. What happened? Where did you go wrong?
Yeah, I know. So true. But so not true. I basically started writing the year after I got out of law school. Mainly because I was working at a big firm and it was very intellectually challenging. I had no medical background. My law firm, who I just love and I'm so grateful I worked there, it kind of operated like the NFL draft. Like the new law student hires would come up on the partner's roll call and they'd say, I like that Caldwell. At the time, they didn't even take into account whether you liked science, new medicine, anything. So, but I was picked and it ended up being great. It was kind of a fantastic thing, but I started writing almost within a year because I thought, you know, school, even though you don't think law school is creative, there are still projects to write with other people and papers that you're given this open topic and you have to sort of let your mind roam and pick up, you know, things. And so I just needed something like that wasn't so scripted as a medical record or a court pleading. And so I picked it up then a year, you know, and I went to University of Iowa, which is thought to be one of the best writing schools in the nation. And I didn't even know it existed. I was not a natural writer. I was not encouraged in college to be a writer because I was not good. And I just picked it up kind of as something I thought it would just be helpful to learn to keep my creative side of my brain operating when I was first practicing law. So that's sort of how I fell into writing later as an adult.
You started out writing contemporary fiction, I guess, labeled... Chicklet. Well.
It's okay. You can say it.
Okay. I'm always a little embarrassed, to say that.
Yeah.
So then you made a conscious decision to switch over to the mystery genre.
May I ask, just for my purposes, why you are interested to say the term chicklet?
Why am I embarrassed?
Yes.
I think it's ghettoization, and I mean. It may be no more or less ghettoization than saying you're a mystery writer, but it seems to me to have been ghettoization and unfair.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the thought, I think, with... I wrote an article recently in the Huffington Post about chicklet because I wrote my first book about a woman who takes a trip to Rome and Greece, and this vacation will change her whole life. And I wrote it just... I didn't even know anything about genres. I didn't know any writers or anyone who did it. I just sort of did it for my own purposes, to learn something creative, to use some different part of my brain. And when I eventually got, you know, sold and selected by Red Dress Inc., they were the first publisher to focus on chick lit. And they were very upfront about, that's what we call it. And I was sort of like, I don't care what you call it. Because I'd gone through 2 years of... I mean, call it vampire lit. There's not a single vampire to be seen, but I'll do it. I hadn't heard the term until they proposed. They ran across my story and they said, "Oh my gosh, this would be great for us." And they liked that I hadn't written it for a genre or for a market. And so that was Red Dress Inc. They were owned by Harlequin. Harlequin tends to know something about selling books. it's sometimes like a tough publisher because you're like, oh, you're romance. And you say, well, I know. But they were amazing. And that term chick lit got me into Malaysia in the Bahasan language. It got me into Australia. And I had a book tour in Australia and a book tour in Italy. And it just got me places I never, ever would have been. So when everyone... Chick lit sort of exploded, and then everyone jumped in. There was mommy lit and religious, aunt lit, and there was like dirt lit from the poverty era, and so it kind of got saturated, and there wasn't as great of product, and so pretty soon everyone was fleeing from the term chick lit, and yet it had brought me my only publishing entree that I knew.
Exactly what I was going to ask about in Publishers Weekly said, when you wrote Look Closely, that you had switched from chick lit to suspense. And it's like, what does that mean?
No, you're totally right. I mean, genre, the genre labeling something as mystery, thriller, suspense, which everyone sees as very distinct, but it's not. And romance or supernatural romance and then a lot of people were complaining that the term chick lit was so denigrating because usually it had to do with a ordinary person who was experiencing something a little extraordinary, maybe over the course of a day, a week, but something kind of otherworldly, not in a supernatural way, just something unique. And so people thought, well, when men write that, and people kept saying Jonathan Franzen, who I read him and love him, and Tom Perata, who I like, can't get enough. And they said, well, if they write quiet books about a guy who's a dad mom, and he's like home with the kids while his wife is working and he has an affair from a woman down the road, that wins a Pulitzer.
That's literature.
Right. It's literature. So that was the debate that was circling that I stayed away from because I was getting into publishing because of it.
Well, we're going to come back to how you've come to some extent full circle and sort of avoided. We'll get to that when we talk about your current book. But I want to talk about something else because I know how significant it is to you and to readers. And that is I don't know how else to describe it, Laura, the life-changing experience you had in, 2007? With a murder trial.
Yeah, I was, I had written a couple of things of chick lit and seen the decline in interest in it, and as luck would have it, I was already writing mysteries on the side. I really did love the craft of writing so much that I said to my husband at the time very often, I don't care if I'm ever bought or published, I will always do this because it just is something that's just mine and it's not my law firm, it's not my husband, it's not my siblings, it's not anybody else except for mine. And so I was always kind of working on a few things and one of them was mysteries. So when chick lit started to take a turn, I had already sort of naturally been going that way. And I was researching a book called The Rome Affair, about a girlfriend's trip to Italy that leads to blackmail and murder. And these girlfriends come back from Rome, and this couple is arrested, and they're in an interrogation room down the hall from each other, and the police are going back and forth, and they're saying to the woman, you know what your husband's saying about you? You know what he's saying about you? He's saying that you pushed her over the balcony. Then they go to the husband and say the same thing. And then it dawned on me that I was channeling Law and Order, like directly channeling. It was, I had to go back and I was like, whoa, nearly plagiarism. So then I thought,
homage.
I got to get some, an homage, if you will. So I called a criminal defense lawyer who I had met. I'd met her briefly one or two times. I knew she was beautiful, cool, and very well respected by everybody, and had represented some fairly large accused people in various mafias and murders. And she really was a due process person who thought people needed to be arrested fairly, interrogated fairly. Anyway, I called her and just said, hey, if this happened in a book, if there was a husband down the hallway, they're in interrogation rooms, and I said, can they ever force them into saying, you know, like, would they ever, do you think they'd be successful in getting them to say something, even if they're not sure if they did it? And she's like, oh, please. She's laughing. She said, that happens all the time. I'm like, what do you mean all the time? She said, honey, I'll give you 2 hours in a room with the Chicago Police Department, and you would say that your mother killed Kennedy. You will put her on the grassy knoll. It is so easy. And I was like, I would never falsely confess to anything. I knew it and I believed it. And then she introduced me to this client of hers who'd been in a jail for 6 years, a holding cell without a trial. He had been falsely confessed to hitting someone twice on the side in a fight where the man was killed by a baseball bat. And so he wasn't involved, and he knew he wasn't involved. And after 3 days in the interrogation room, they said, you know what? Just tell us you threw a couple punches. Then you go home. And trust me, at that point, especially if you're innocent, your innocence plays against you. You're like, get me out of here. I'll take care of this later. So he signs, and he gets charged with death penalty murder, and they put him in a holding cell. And he was there for 6 years until that attorney, Kathy, who I called for a research question, found him. And I happened to call her 3 weeks after she had found him, stumbled across him in a county jail. I ended up trying the case with her, and that's my only nonfiction book, which is called Long Way Home.
That book, which is a very powerful story, led you to do more than just be a writer. When you were already teaching at Loyola, you were teaching
Yes. Legal
writing?
I didn't want to give up my law license, and one way was to teach, so I taught. I created a course called Advanced Legal Writing and taught trial lawyers how to write motions for summary judgment and how to argue a motion to dismiss. And in the federal system, what did that mean? So I was doing that and then starting to teach more about international criminal law and getting more into teaching and basically just settling into this nice teaching and writing thing. And then this trial happened, and both Kathy and I, the young man's name was Jovan Mosley, and both Kathy and I were not in love, but we loved the kid, and we knew that if we lost this trial for him, he lost that trial for him or whoever, that he would go away for the majority of his life to prison, and the person that we knew and were representing wouldn't exist in there anymore. So it really felt like you had someone's life in your hands because you knew where he would go if you didn't succeed. It wasn't just a negative result. It was, you will essentially in some way be causing the death of this person. Nancy, you're nodding.
I said it was life or death.
It really felt like that. So and I really regretted doing it.
So once you got Jovan exonerated, mm-hmm. This led to a bigger idea for you.
Yeah, Jovan ended up, he was accused of murder because of this fight. He wasn't in the fight. Eventually we did exonerate him. He got inoculated. And he had nothing when he got out of jail. Even the day that there was a not guilty, Kathy and I thought that you have to go back to the jail and be processed, and you have stuff there by that time if you've been there for 6 years. So there's paperwork, and so we thought his mom would be contacted, and she'd be picking him up. She thought we would be contacted and picking him up. And in fact, they walked him down this long, long, dark hallway at 2 in the morning. He had gotten the not guilty at like 2 or 3 in the afternoon. And they walked him down a long hallway and walked him out onto a very bleak street and a very, to be honest, scary street where the criminal court system is located. And they pretty much told him good luck. Someone did give him a bus card. And we were so horrified, you know, the next day when we called his mom, she's like, I thought you had him, and we thought you had him. And a guard had ended up taking him in. This guard let him rent, you know, for like $2 a month at first, her basement. So he moved into someone's unfinished basement, and his family had lost or given away all his clothes while he was in because they really thought that he was gone. They kind of didn't understand the legal proceedings. And so he had nothing. Like, he didn't have a bar of soap to wash his face with or a razor, much less a cell phone. He didn't know how to work a laptop. He didn't understand what email was. He'd been in for long enough that he'd missed a whole bunch of things. So seeing that caused us at Loyola Law School to start a program called Life After Innocence for people who've been in jail and they're innocent, and then they get out and are exonerated.
So the program works with these people. So they do all of them get compensation from the state?
No, unfortunately. I think that's the prevailing mindset. I think most people in the world, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, here, if you're in the United States, if you're a Republican or Democrat or what religion you are, like almost no one wants someone who's innocent to be convicted, maybe with the exception of OJ and that sports memorabilia case. However, you know, in general, everyone tends to say, you know, cops, prosecutors, defense lawyers, Republicans, Democrats, Christians, you know, Islam, everyone says, if you're innocent, you probably shouldn't go to jail. Like, everyone kind of gets that. And yet it plays out a little differently. And in fact, most people, like two-thirds of people who get out of jail shown to be innocent, about two-thirds will receive anything of any kind. And so what the public sees is this, and it is fantastic. Freedom is better than anything. But what we say is freedom is just the beginning. Because you'll see these people like coming out of jail and they're just like, oh my God, their first taste of open sky, open air in 20 years, nothing shackling them. They're not being led to a van. And, you know, there's their lawyers around them and their family. And that actually only happens about, I mean, when we see those things, everyone thinks that happens all the time. But a lot more often people are walked down a hallway like Javon is and unceremoniously walked onto the street. It's happened to many of our clients. And again, two-thirds of them will just never recover anything from the state or anybody, in large part because sometimes wrongful convictions are not anybody's fault.
There are programs, obviously, for parolees. There are programs to rehabilitate ex-felons. But until you came along, there was nothing for innocent folks.
Well, it just was, there was only, it only had gotten started where they were devoting funds to the innocence work. And so finally, there were a number of innocence organizations up and running around the country. And they are amazing people, and they do the hardest, hardest work. And they have to believe in nothing except for their client. And they get people out, and they do so much to help them start over. They all do what we did with Jovan. They help them try to get an ID. They help them try to figure out some clothes. They're like, here's a cell phone. Here's how you work it. But they're not receiving their funding to help people start over, and in large part because just nobody thought, it seemed pretty great. Like, you're innocent. You're finally out. Oh, my God. Right. Enjoy, dude.
What more do we need to do?
We all help you go to a beach.
Right. Well, what more do we need to do for you? We got you out.
Right. But what we just ended up finding out, and I guess what I found out obliquely from working with on that murder case, was that when you get out, you start from scratch. You start from zero. And we just wanted to step up and sort of, if we could help out after they were out, if we could help get their records expunged. Another thing I think people don't know is that when you're wrongfully convicted and you get out of jail, it remains on your record.
Well, let's talk about something lighter for a bit. Let's talk about your current book.
Okay, let's do it. Everybody shake it off.
That's right. We need
Nancy and I will do our dog shake.
That's right.
Right. So it's a book about a dog, but not really about a dog because, you know.
Right.
So tell us, how did the book come about?
Well, I got a divorce and then I got a dog. And then I fell in love with the dog. And then I was in my mid-40s and I had made the decision over and over not to have kids in a very reflective way and not without its agonizing. But I knew I wasn't going to have kids, so it was kind of fun to just throw myself into. I'm like, sure, I'm in my 40s and I have a dog and I'm not going to have a kid. I don't care what you think. I'm having a blast. So I just sort of owned it, I guess, and I just loved it. I just been having the most fun time. And my publisher, who is essentially this, I've been published with other people, but they're the same publisher who originally bought me for Burning the Map when I was found myself in Chiclet. And they suggested to me, because they monitor my Facebook and Twitter pages, and they said, you know, it went from like books, exonerees, books, innocence, you know, books, Barry Shack, like, exonerees. And then it was like, dog, and everything was about the dog. So they didn't say it like this, but it was kind of like, do you want to get that out of your system? And they said, let us do what we do well. We do, you know, romantic comedies and fun summer beach books that run fast, but they have good characters. They said, write something about that that has at its prominence a dog, and we'll get it out there for you, and then you can decide. So this was actually the last book in my contract, and my agent and I talked about it, and she's like, do you want to do it? I'm like, yeah! It just seemed like the most fun thing I'd ever heard of, especially just the last 5 years being fortunate enough to work with the Innocence community and seeing what hard work people do and the exonerees go through. It just felt like a vacation.
So it's called The Dog Park.
Do you think you'll go back to, I just want to jump in, but do you think you'll go back to Izzy McNeil now?
Yeah, so I felt like Izzy McNeil was my sort of blend of what we don't call chick lit anymore and like mystery thriller. And so when I had one more book in my contract with them, they kind of stepped back and we all looked at, we have two trilogies. We have 6 books with Izzy McNeil. Red Hot Lies was the first in the first trilogy. You can read any of them in any order. And they went on to the second trilogy was a little different. I had one more book in my contract and they realized, well, this is going to be good for backlist. We can package it this way and that. And so I recently moved to Izzy's neighborhood and I walk around and I see her sometimes in my mind's eye and I see her parents' house all the time and it's exactly like I remember it. And so in my mind, she's out there sort of living without me and doing her thing, and maybe I'll check back in with her.
So what's next?
Well, Les, thank you for asking.
Well, I hear you're going to be working with a really terrific author on a new book.
I have asked Mr. Les Plinger to help me with an anthology that would sort of pair the thriller writing that either I've done or people we know have done with Innocence work. So what we're hoping is to pair and just like an amazing thriller writer like Wee Child or, you know, like just somebody amazing, Laurie King, Grisham, somebody, and then pair them with an exoneree, someone who was in prison and now innocent and now out, to tell, it's called, we're the working title is Anatomy of Innocence. That was yours, Les, right? That was good.
That's my only
take
credit.
Full
here.
Credit and
take
your
full credit for the title. The whole book is your idea. I came up with the title.
So we're calling it Anatomy of Innocence, and what it would do is tell the story of a wrongful conviction. Because so we're called Life After Innocence at Loyola Chicago, and one of our missions has to just been to educate people that wrongful convictions happen. It really isn't even always an evil or bad thing. This is a human system. The criminal justice system is not a factory where we put people in and say, what's the truth? And we spit it out. It's a human system. And it's obviously, therefore, going to have its failures. And at Life After Innocence, we just say, thank you to the people who are doing the hard work and getting people out who are innocent. And how can we help afterwards? But what people, as we're coming to educate people about wrongful convictions and more people understand that this exists, the feedback we often hear is, but I just don't understand how it happened. Like, why did he first get picked up? Or if he did falsely confess, why would he say that? And what happened when he was in prison? Why is he so cheerful now? What happened when he got out? So we're trying to tell the whole arc or the whole curve of the story of wrongful convictions through a chapter, each told by a thriller writer paired with an exoneree. So maybe we'd put Lee Child with Antoine Day, and they would tell just the story of a small part of the arrest or something like that. But in a way that once you've read, you could read them in pieces and they don't need to go together, but if you want to read it as a whole, it tells the story of how wrongful convictions happen.
I could make my excuse for involvement be Sherlockian and say that Holmes has always been driven by justice. But honestly, I'm a lawyer too, and this part of the criminal process just has always really bothered me. And Laura, you know, I've been a supporter of the project from day one, and I'm just thrilled to be involved with this. And
I should say that we should talk about the other anthology that I'm in that's coming out.
Yes. November. Well, since we're plugging, we're doing
since we're chug.
We have Laura is a contributor to the book that you know I've been editing called In the Company of Sherlock Holmes. We have an amazing group of writers in that collection. It comes out November 10th. And since we're advertising, we might as well say a whole bunch of us will be at VoucherCon in Long Beach, and we hope to see many of the readers there. This is co-edited with Laurie King.
When will we be in VoucherCon?
VoucherCon, Nancy, I think it's
I think 12th? It's November 10th. I think
it starts November 10th. So.
Okay, that worked out really nicely.
Yes,
coincidence? I don't know.
No. Destiny.
My next hope is that I can sell something that I'm either working on or have worked on into TV or film. But that's, you know, like every TV writer wants to be a novelist, and every novelist wants to write TV.
Or at least they want their story to be purchased by TV.
Purchased, right.
Right, and then they
purchase
think
option and worked
it.
On by someone else who won't destroy it and continue the same theme and the same tonal involvement that you had.
But on the other hand, there's a lot of demand for content right now with the, you know, growth of Netflix and Amazon and all of the basic cable channels and Showtime and HBO. There's a demand, and I would think that Izzy would make a fantastic character for a TV show.
I think so, too. And when they first came out, when we first put the first few out, we explored it. And TV hadn't really exploded the way it has now. People weren't binge-watching. They weren't putting things out a season at a time. They weren't available on Netflix or other providers. And so we're about to revisit that, and I'm hoping, because I think it would be amazing content, and the content is done, and, you know, we've got 6 books and about 36 million subplots that I feel like run through them, and then I'm always like, oh, I need a flow chart. Where's my NFL game chart, you know?
There's one other thing that we should talk about a little bit. Laura, you've now, you're on your second Edgar jury? And
are we allowed to talk about that?
Well, we're not going to talk about the
details. We shouldn't talk about which one.
I just wanted to talk about the Edgar process a little bit.
Yeah.
So the Edgars I hope our listeners know, the Edgars are the Oscars of the mystery world given out by the Mystery Writers of America. And what we have is a juried system where writers agree to volunteer to be members of juries in various categories. This is you did last year. You did first novel. Was it last year?
What we were doing is somebody would read 4 or 5 books and then email the whole and just sort of check in and say I enjoyed this. I'm not sure about this one. And then somebody else would come back and say, well, give that other one another look. And so we kept in loose contact. And I was sort of wondering today if that was. That was how this generally works or is supposed to work. But it was good because a lot of times, what I mostly found from that was that a lot of times I had started something and I decided to give everything 30 pages. And I would start one and I would get through my 30 pages. And sometimes through no fault of the book or the author, I was in a certain mood and therefore not receptive. And a couple of times, you know, I heard from another author or whatever on the jury, oh, God, though, did you notice this? Check that out. And I go back in a different frame of mind, and I think, oh, thank God somebody told me. This was a great book. And I was just in a mood. So it actually taught me to, if I put books down now, I don't put them down with, ugh, I'm done with that book. I just put it down. And if it's been on my nightstand, you know, then for like 8 months, I'm like, all right, it's done for now. And then we move it out. But, yeah, it's been a delight to do this, even though
That's what I wanted to ask about, is sort of why. Yeah. Why did you want to do this, and especially first novel, which is not quite as bad as novel in terms of glutton for punishment.
Right.
But burdensome. Why did you want to
do this? Well, I just think, too, I just love the concept of, first of all, just new writers being encouraged and given accolades for what they've done. My friend David Ellis... won an Edgar for best first, and my friend Teresa Schwagel won best first. And so I've known people who've won it deservedly, and I know what an amazing you know, just saying good job. I mean, it's just a really like an industry way of saying to a very new person, instead of, you know, whatever, you can't get in. I've worked this network forever. It's saying good for you, you know? And so that was really fun for me. And then also I just felt like it's your duty. I mean, I've only won like some, you know, one or two awards. I want an Edgar so bad I can taste it. But I felt like it was my duty. You can't always submit and not contribute, you know?
Well, so, Nancy, did I usurp all the questions on your list?
No, just the one. I wanted to ask the chick lit question, and Laura so eloquently answered it. So, you know, what can I say? I guess my only other question, and you did address it a little bit, was you're in pretty good company with writers like Scott Turow and John Grisham and Linda Fairstein in attorneys that have turned to crime writing. So is
and
there...
Bess Slinger. Not really.
Bess Slinger.
Different.
And probably many, many others. And to a certain extent, you've explained that in law school you needed that outlet for creativity. So that would have been my only other question.
Also, trial lawyers are taught how to tell stories. I mean, Scott Turow has done various things, but, you know, corporate work, and Grisham has done big tobacco work. I represented doctors. But no matter what your client is, you're still, if you're doing jury trials, you're standing up in front of a group of 12 people, and you're saying, look, here's what happened. She went into the hospital. Her hip was hurting. All tests were negative, and you tell the story, and then you tell it in your way, and the other attorney will tell it in their way. And it's funny that you mentioned that, Nancy, or you bring it up, because my first writing teacher, who recently passed away, wrote a book. He had a thing called "Is Jerry Cleaver," and he had a workshop called The Loft here in Chicago. And eventually, he wrote a book with Putnam, I believe it is, about fiction writing. He was just a great teacher. And he eventually, the only advertising he did for the last decade of his workshop was in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. All he had to do was say, I've got a story workshop, and you can learn how to write a novel, too. And lawyers flocked to it, because even if they didn't write a novel, they learned more about how to tell a good story when they get up in front of a jury. And I just think, you know, litigation people are natural storytellers. Even if you get up in front of a judge and you're arguing a motion, you still have to give a quick little story. Judge, this is on a case that has to do with an accident, a light was out, and da-da-da-da, and you have to give a little story. So I think it's just kind of this natural inclination.
We have some fantastic interviews scheduled for the next few weeks. Perfect for the dog days, David Rosenfeld will talk about his latest lawyer and dog lover, Andy Carpenter mystery, Hounded. Nick Harkaway will discuss his latest genre-bending novel, Tiger Man. Matt Cook, whose first thriller, Sabotage, will be published in September. And Laurie King will talk Mary Russell and In the Company of Sherlock Holmes, the upcoming collection of Sherlock Holmes' John Watson stories written by contemporary authors, including Laura Caldwell, that she and Les are releasing on November 11th. Until next week, this is Nancy Clare. Thank you for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.